This is Rain Perry, and you're listening to Cinderblock Bookshelves, a guide for children of fame-obsessed bohemian nomads, the collaboration between myself and KWMR Point Reyes Station. Chapter 2. I should mention here that I didn't actually live in Inverness this whole time. The reality of single parenthood is a little more unremitting than its utopian ideal, and in the fourth grade, my dad sent me to live with his older sister, Deli, in Colorado, a year which involved no cinder blocks of any kind. But I missed my dad. When I returned from Colorado, my dad had moved to a new house and planted a mandala garden in the backyard, plus a secret crop of pot plants. My dad secured a job as a chef at Manka's Inverness Lodge, where he would accidentally make too many raspberry sauce Suzettes, and I'd have to eat the extras. I don't think I showed my friends the plants in the backyard, but somebody stole them right when they were gleaming with resin, a serious loss of income. At the same time, my dad led an employee strike against Manka's owners, and not long after, he had to take a less well-paying restaurant job at the Gibson House in Bolinas. We hauled the cinder blocks to a communal house down the street and then down to Second Valley. We moved into a shared room on Inverness Way and finally to a trailer up on the ridge. That's the trailer on my album cover. My dad took a job at the Plaza Movie Theater in Petaluma. They had cult films, real butter on the popcorn, and good coffee. The one drawback, of course, was that it paid hardly anything. So, my dad augmented his income by standing in waders in waist-deep muck, harvesting oysters for the Johnson Oyster Company. I'm pretty sure it was this job that made him decide it was time to leave Inverness. Plus, his girlfriend's ability to endure the challenges of being with him had reached its painful limit. He appealed to his sisters and received an invitation from Francie to live and work on her new ranch. So we took the train to Albuquerque, and in my seventh grade year, Dad was a rancher in southwestern Colorado, where the girls shaved their legs and their arms. Then we traveled from there to the San Fernando Valley just in time for the disco to new wave transition. At Christmas time, my dad worked selling knockoff perfume at Zodi's department store, as in, if you like white shoulders, you'll love our number 36. I was sent ahead up to his new girlfriend's house in Upper Ojai. There was nothing to do. I lurked around with the guitar my dad gave me and my super hits of the 70s songbook. Imagine Heart of Glass played unplugged. But fate brought two teenage boys into my life, and this is a song about them.
In the sticks of Southern California, I never see the sun. I spend summer trying to figure out how Neil Young hammers on the D string, a needle and the damage done by watching Brockett's fingers on the frets. Danny's more concerned with how he looks when he plays. He does the best he can to resemble Jimmy Page with his guitar down to his knees. Don't know how he plays that way, but it works upon me just as it's in. Down the hall,
The songwriting of this period could be called the early years, or perhaps the earnest years. Themes explored include crushes on guitar players.
Several years back.
Nature ballads.
I wanna go where rivers flow, where songs are new, and skies are blue.
And other deep musings.
When you're blind, first you realize.
Creating a new song was the most thrilling thing I'd ever done, at least until my freshman year of high school, which I spent at an alternative private boarding school in the mountains outside Durango, Colorado, where, like all my classmates, I was growing up faster than I'd anticipated. I'd proudly written to my father not long before, updating him, as usual, that I am really and truly into the world of boys. And I can imagine myself having sex in the near future. On my next scheduled collect call home from the payphone outside the school office, he advised me, "Rain, you know, I'm not there to guide you, and you're going to do what you're going to do, but you can deal with that teenage male intensity and, you know, release some of your own hormonal energy if you go, you know, off by yourself and, you know, oh my God, Dad. I know, God. I knew all about it, having discovered in my aunt's attic both the joy of sex with the illustrations of its enthusiastic and uninhibited couple, the man looking way too much like my bearded father, and everything you always wanted to know about sex but were afraid to ask, with its lurid tales of bathhouses and venereal disease. Adults in my world discuss sex quite freely. I knew, for example, that my dad and his girlfriends preferred diaphragms, which were, in fact, the contraceptive of choice amongst the sexually liberated, to be incorporated into the act as part of lovemaking. But for logistical reasons, I wasn't likely to be using one myself. Even though they were unenlightened, it was likely to be rubbers for me. And I had some. My sex ed class had been on a field trip to Planned Parenthood, and they'd sent us home with multi-packs of tropical-colored condoms. The rubbers sat in my bathroom cabinet for a month or so. One night, fooling around with my boyfriend, Peter, against my father's advice, I decided this was to be the night. To his everlasting credit, Peter said, "Are you sure? Once you cross that line, you can never go back." I was sure. I went into the bathroom, changed into a really sexy floral flannel nightgown, and retrieved one of the two reserved rubbers, red, I think, the lights in the cabin all on. When you're 14 and 16, there's no mood, there's no vibe. There's either nervous anticipation or speedy, awkward making out. I came back to my bed and watched him put it on. And then I watched it break. Back to the bathroom for the remaining rubber. And so I made my best attempt to lose my virginity to a boy in a yellow tropical condom. Peter was patient and encouraging, suggesting I pretend it's a tampon. Unfortunately, my experience with those was limited at that point as well, although I did know that I'd never encountered one of this dimension. It kind of worked, but my willingness wasn't matched by relaxation, and despite much earnest effort, we finally called it a night, and I was left wondering if this really counted as the moment I'd irreversibly crossed the line. Well, whether I'd technically been deflowered or not, it was close enough for me. The next morning, the world looked different. I was sure everyone could tell. and in case they couldn't, I told nearly everyone. It was a sign of relationships to come for a while that I ditched Peter and gambled on a tortured crush on an 18-year-old senior named Greg. I had spent many an evening with competitively depressed friends in Greg's cabin, drinking coffee and listening to Bruce Springsteen's Point Blank and the Moody Blues' Nights in White Satin. Greg had been winning the depression contest all year because his girlfriend had moved away and he could think of nothing but her and skiing. His dark eyes crinkled with anguish, which made my longing for him exquisite. Since I was known not to be a virgin the night I was the last one in Greg's cabin, there was little ceremony to the genuine event. Greg was remarkably casual as he offered a back rub and then told me all about his girlfriend. I unsuspectingly wondered, does this mean he likes me? And within about 5 minutes, there was no doubt I'd lost my virginity for real. Interestingly, the next morning I did not have the impulse to tell everyone. Goofy tropical condoms seemed oddly comforting, and I wished I hadn't so impulsively deserted Peter. Years from that night, I'd write a similar scene to the one with Greg and discuss it in a writer's group. One man in the group said he didn't really buy the scene because it wasn't realistic. "It's so clumsy and mundane," he mansplained. "You need to make it more like a young girl's awakening, her exploration of her sexuality." Huh.
"Hi, Rita? This is Rain. Is my dad around?"
"Now I'm hugging. Good to meet you, to girlfriend 23. Now a month's gone by and the shelves go up in a room she's cleared for me. Now it's coming down to money, and they're not getting along. She can't give him the support he needs, so once again we're gone on the highway together, my daddy and me. From where can we live freely to where can we stay for free? And the open road's potential, like a diamond in the rough, closed into the path of least resistance. By the time I
I finished my freshman year at boarding school on a partial scholarship that turned into a full one when my dad didn't pay the tuition bills, and then came back to Ojai with my dad, who'd secured a job selling sailboats in Ventura Harbor. His grandmother died during this time, and we flew to New York for the funeral. And there, I met many of the people my dad had left behind in his flight from Indian Hill. When we got home, he was looking at the world differently. He'd inherited money again. Once the check arrived, and we celebrated with a sushi dinner, it took little time for him to decide that it was best to quit his job at Ventura Yacht Sales and buy a Soloflex exercise machine. Remember those ones with the big rubber bands? A great stereo and a record collection to rival the one he'd had to sell when I was a little kid. He also booked time at Goldmine Recording Studio for me to cut demos of some of the songs I've been writing. This post-inheritance time was fun. We ate Haagen-Dazs. He bought scalp tickets to see Bruce Springsteen. He treated himself to some cocaine, a little of which he thoughtfully shared with me on the way down to the concert. He began to write a new screenplay with a friend from Pasadena Playhouse, and a corkboard in the living room was once again filled with 3x5 cards. A few months later, in late 1983, we flew to Boston to spend Christmas with two of my dad's sisters, and while we were there, visit the Berklee School of Music. I didn't know it then, but our trip was preceded by an appeal by my dad. "Rather than perceiving of this as a loan, I'd like you to consider it an investment in me, in Rain, and in our future. These past 10 years of single parenthood have severely curtailed my ability to pursue fully my film and stage career. This is the year to emerge from the tunnel, was the message he sent to his single parent sister, Piper. I visited Berklee College of Music, feeling a bit like Jennifer Beals in Flashdance when she visits the ballet school and is intimidated and runs away. We spent Christmas with my aunts and cousins. Everyone looked so preppy in their sweaters and slacks. And the day after Christmas, I overheard my dad and Piper arguing heatedly behind the dividing door between her study and the dining room. The gist of it was he'd spent the money to buy the tickets to visit for Christmas because he was under the impression she was going to lend him money. She was under the impression he was visiting because he wanted to see her. Despite the setback, we continued with our vacation. The family all went to see Cats. Mungo, Jerry, and Rumpelteazer, Jellicle. Ugh, I hated it. My dad and I drove down to New York and stayed in a brownstone of some vacationing cousins and saw Al Pacino on Broadway in American Buffalo. Guys like that, he shouted. I like to fuck their wives. I loved it. I believe we flew back the next day. We came home to California to a January eviction notice and several hundred more dollars owed on the credit card. The chickens had settled cozily into their proverbial roost. My dad sold the stereo system. A friend had a sailboat in Ventura Harbor, and Dad worked out a deal for himself to live aboard in exchange for refinishing the decks. But there wasn't room for me and no way for me to get from the harbor to school in Ojai on a daily basis. So for another time in our cohabitation, Dad had to find somewhere else for me to live. Yet again, someone jumped in. First, an artist friend. And when she had to move, another friend in Ojai who made room for me in the available space in her house, which happened to be the bottom bunk of her 12-year-old son's bed. In many respects, this was a good arrangement. Jesse was sweetly blatant as he worked his plan of seduction upon me. Hey, Rain, he'd say, cornering me in the hall by the bathroom. Let's go all the way. Sadly for Jesse, though, I had a boyfriend by this time, a punk from a band called Invisible Government. My father's college savings plan, in fact, his plan for everything, had been the infamous script that he would sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars someday. To quote a term I learned in English class, the screenplay would be the deus ex machina, the plot device that appears at the end of the story, ties up all loose threads, and secures a happy ending. My dad was sure that when the screenplay sold, he could send me to the college of my choice, retire his debt to the IRS, and repay with interest the friends from whom he'd borrowed money over the years. But the end of the last act of my childhood was now upon us, and no bidding war appeared from the heavens to save us.
Hi, Jane? It's Rain. How was the Rolfing session? Oh, great. Anyway, are you going down to the boat today? Can you get a message to my dad?
The college letters came in June. Berklee School of Music, predictably perhaps, suggested I shore up my knowledge of theory and reapply in the future. I was accepted to UCLA, but with my father unable to pay his own rent, there was no money for me to go. So I took the fall quarter off and transferred my acceptance to UC Santa Barbara, where I could commute. My college-bound friends were off at their freshman year at school, so I rarely saw them. And my fellow drama geeks had escaped Ojai as fast as possible and made daring moves to New York and San Francisco. In their absence, I hung out mostly with my father and his friends. I spent my 18th birthday with people who were 20 years older than me. After a while, my dad again returned to Ojai with a new girlfriend, and it just made sense for me to move back in with him. He reassumed his paternal role, which bugged me a bit, since it seemed unconnected to any requirement that he actually be paternal. He was hardly ever around. During that time, he pulled himself out of poverty and depression by commencing a lucrative phase as an ecstasy dealer. Ecstasy. In the mid-80s in Southern California, everyone was taking it. He had a source in Santa Barbara, a couple of hollow aerosol cans to transport the pills in, and a creepy L.A. connection we met one time near a Kentucky Fried Chicken on Wilshire. When you called to ask for some, you had to say cassettes, as in, I need a dozen of your cassettes for a party I'm having this weekend. At the same time, my dad actually was selling cassettes called The Channel Islands, an audio postcard, so it got confusing once in a while.
For example, the giant coreopsis, or tree sunflower, withered and grotesque-looking most of the year, explodes in a display of bright green and yellow.
It's weird buying drugs from your dad. You think he should give them to you for free because he's your dad. But it didn't seem weird to do drugs with my dad, and there were many groovy ecstasy evenings in our pillow-laden living room, appreciating the camaraderie of friends while listening to the spirited harp rhythms of Andreas Wohlenwieder. You take the pill, and then wait half an hour. And then you find yourself staring at a wall. Wow, you think, I'm high. Then your body goes on a mission to release all tension, so you stretch and yawn and clench your teeth and sigh the ecstasy sigh. You have no patience for bullshit. Your self-esteem skyrockets for 3 to 5 hours. You say things like, this is how we're supposed to feel. There's no reason to hold back your feelings for other humans, either. One night, one of Dad's new acquaintances stopped by when my dad and his girlfriend were out. He had come to pick something up, probably ecstasy, and when he saw no one else was home, suggested we go for a drive. And even though I'd only met him a couple of times, I inexplicably agreed. Let's take some E, he suggested. Okay. And later, I became acquainted with the inability to say no that is one of the significant contraindicators of ecstasy. And I came home with the first secret too big to tell my dad.
I wanted something different, and boy, that's what I got. Wiser than my years, but it turns out that I'm not. I should be nursing a crush on some shy young punk, hanging with friends too late. Not dragged from the muck on a Monday, half awake.
The secret escalated because a week later, the guy and his girlfriend moved into a house with my father and his girlfriend, and I couldn't see my dad without seeing him, so he convinced me to keep seeing him secretly. When the truth finally slipped out at the behest of my dad's friend, everybody freaked out, including my dad. He was furious at me. Why? Why did he demand to know everything, which I couldn't bring myself to tell him? Why didn't he speak to me for days? Anyway, I loved the Beatles' Within You, Without You. You know, that line about all the people who hide themselves be behind a wall. You know, they don't know. They can't see. Are you one of them? I never wanted to be one of them. But we have defenses for a reason. You can't be open about everything, she says, as she tells all about her defloweration and drug use on the radio. You can be honest and true without letting people hurt you, which, in addition to the potential brain damage, is really the biggest pitfall to an otherwise ideal drug.
We're sorry. You have reached a number that has been disconnected or is no longer in service. If you feel you have reached this recording in error, please check the number and try your call again.
I moved to Santa Barbara that winter. My dad and I limped closer, but we treated each other warily. What kind of adult relationship would we have? This was the era of Live Aid, the Hunger Project, and nuclear protests at England's Greenham Common. So I joined anti-apartheid demonstrations at UCSB, which brought a vision of Benetton-clad kinship with my brethren in a worldwide progressive movement. Woo-hoo! Getting arrested! We stayed in Cheadle Hall after closing time, just before they hauled us away. We weren't cuffed, but we were cited and released. Almost 70 of us, and we totally called ourselves the Cheadle 69. In Santa Barbara, the Forum kept popping up on my radar. As I made the rounds of my freshman year, I bumped into some people who'd done the Forum, and they seemed so motivated and on the ball. They had something I didn't, purpose, a finger on the pulse of something bigger. They carried day runners. A ball started rolling in my brain. A voice in my head started to say, "You should do this. This will help." I need help, I thought. You've been listening to Cinderblock Bookshelves, a guide for children of fame-obsessed bohemian nomads, a collaboration between Rain Perry, that's me, and KWMR Point Reyes Station. Thank you, Amanda Eichstadt, and everyone at the station. Recording, sound editing, and music by Ken Arrows. The album, Cinderblock Bookshelves, was produced by Mark Hallman at the Congress House in Austin, Texas, and is available wherever you find your music. Cinderblock Bookshelves, the play, was written by Rain Perry and performed by Rain Perry and Danny B. Harvey. It had its world premiere at Theater 150 in Ojai, California, on February 8, 2008. It was directed by Kim Maxwell and produced by Sasha Heslip. With set design by Robert Pryor, sound design by Dirk Schubert of Schubert Systems Group, and visual effects by Owen Renfro. Music concepts for the play were developed with the assistance of Danny B. Harvey and Jonathan Raffetto. Thank you for listening.